is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyis Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is just a piece of rubbish. Nothing new except the usual rhetoric from the same culpable players whose hand has always been visible as far as disturbances in this country are concerned.
That's the spokesman for Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party reacting to warnings by several embassies that the government should not use COVID-19 as a pretext to stifle citizens' rights. Details coming up. Also, Sudan's government has signed a peace agreement with rebel groups. And Cameroon says it is increasing security along its borders with the Central African Republic and Nigeria. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Sudan's transitional government has signed a historic peace agreement with rebel groups, raising hopes of ending more than 17 years of war. The ceremony took place in South Sudan's capital, Juba, after a year of stumbling negotiations, as Nabab Mohideen reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's transitional government signed the peace deal Monday with the Sudan Revolutionary Front, SRF, a coalition of rebel groups from the regions of Darfur, Southern Kordofan, and the Blue Nile. The historic agreement made after a year of talks hosted by South Sudan offers power sharing, integration into security forces, land rights, and the return of those displaced from years of conflict. Two rebel factions within the Sudan Liberation Movement, SLM, and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, SPLMN, refused to take a part in the peace process. But Sudan's transitional government spokesman Faisal Saleh still praised the deal. He says peace is the first priority out of 10 issues the transitional government has determined to begin addressing. He says since last September, a delegation went to Juba and announced the Juba Declaration. Saleh says the transitional government is happy to accomplish this step, but they are aware that still more rounds of talks will be needed with SLM and SPLMN. To hopefully achieve a comprehensive peace, the rebel fought troops sent by former President Omar al-Bashir, who was ousted by the military in April 2019 after a month of popular protest and replaced with a joint military-civilian government. Bashir is serving jail time for corruption and is wanted by the International Criminal Court, ICC, for genocide and crimes against humanity in Darfur. Sudan's delegation to Monday's signing ceremony included Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and the head of the Transitional Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. But the deal was signed by Sudan's commander of fighters in the conflict, Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, known as Himiti, who rights groups say committed many of the abuses in Darfur. Himiti and Burhan were also blamed for attacks against anti-Bashir protesters in Khartoum in June 2019 and left over 120 people dead. Protest leaders agreed to a power-sharing deal with the military, whereby Sudan is to hold its first democratic election in decades in 2022. Nabah Mohideen for VUA News, Khartoum.
Over the past week, multiple protests in Libya's western region, specifically in Tripoli and Zawiya, so civilians criticize the UN-backed government of national unity over water, power, and corruption. Reports on the Tripoli protests suggest that armed groups aligned with the Ministry of Interior opened fire on the civilians, sparking widespread condemnation and the firing of influential Interior Minister Fatih Basaga. With such division within the GNA, the situation in Libya is getting more complicated. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Wolfgang Porstai, a security analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, about the developments.
The situation in Libya is getting even increasingly complex. Many of the population hoped that after the defeat of the Libyan National Army at the gates of Tripoli, there would be a turn to the better. But they were deeply disappointed, and so they are now out on the roads. Ordinary people of the broader Tripoli civilian society are the backbone. They are most of the protesters who are out on the roads. But there are also some affiliates of Haftar's Libyan National Army, some people from the powerful city of Misrata, and some members of the Muslim Brotherhood who have mixed into the crowd and who try now to exploit and steer and guide the demonstrations for their respective own objects. Members of the Sarraj loyal Tripoli Protection Force, which belongs also to the Ministry of the Interior, tried to disperse the demonstrations, at times by shooting into the crowd. Quite interestingly, these militias of the Tripoli Protection Force are among those Minister of Interior Fateh Bashagha wants to disband. And by their reaction, the Tripoli Protection Force militias also wanted to prove their value to Prime Minister Sarraj. Sarraj supporters claim that Bashagha somehow even encouraged the protests instead of trying to get them under control.
Could the public dissatisfaction assist the efforts by the international community to reform the presidential council in Libya?
Yes, absolutely, it should, because this current situation clearly demonstrates that the current political system has failed. The 9-member Shkirat Presidential Council, established by the Shkirat Agreement in 2015, headed by Sarraj, has failed, and reform is urgently required. 3 of the members have already resigned. The president of the elected parliament of the House of Representatives, which is based in the east in Tobruk, Agila Saleh, proposed a new 3-member presidential council, with 1 representative chosen by each of the regions, of the historic regions, Cyrenaica, Fezzan, and Tripolitania. While selecting them would be already a quite complex exercise in Cyrenaica and Fezzan, this is probably next to impossible in Tripolitania. Having a look on the current members from Tripolitania, there is Sarraj, who is currently struggling for his political survival. There is Ahmed Maitik, who represents more or less the Misrata businessman establishment. There is Abdul Salam Kajman, representative of the Muslim Brotherhood. Omar al-Aswad from Sintan. None of them would be willing to give up his position. None of the entities behind these people would be willing to make a compromise. And another question would be, if there is an agreement on who could represent Tripolitania, Cyrenaica, and Fezzan, who could legitimate the new presidential council? So the issue of reforming the presidential council is a very, very complicated issue.
So could the division within the GNA impede any potential progress in the quest for a political solution in Libya?
Absolutely. An already nearly hopeless situation gets again more difficult. Sarraj was never ever the master in his own house, never ever had Tripoli under control. But now several of the conflicts, of the internal conflicts, have surfaced, weakening him even more, if he is able to survive. The struggle in Tripoli is mostly about power, influence, and money. Let me outline a little bit the various circles. There is a group around Sarraj who brought several second and third line members of the former regime back into important positions. 2 examples are the newly appointed Minister of the Interior and the Minister of Defense. And they allow for the criminal businesses of the Tripoli Protection Force who protected them right now against the protesters. Next ones are the Misrata and the Muslim Brotherhood, who have well placed many of their followers in economic institutions and within security apparatus. Several of them are unfortunately highly corrupt. Another one are the Salafists among Libya's Grand Mufti. They have promoted some key figures of the former Libyan Islamic fighting groups into important positions, especially also in the security apparatus. If Sarraj is getting sacked now, the international recognition of the GNA would probably be also gone. Sarraj is legitimated, at least internationally, by the endorsement of the Shkirat Agreement by the UN Security Council. I doubt that the UN Security Council would be willing to legitimate any success of Sarraj. So it was probably the High Council of State would step forward, which is dominated by Islamists right now. In a nutshell, to conclude, it's a real mess.
That was Wolfgang Poshtai, a security analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. President Emmerson Mnangagwa's ruling party has dismissed as rubbish a statement by Western diplomats warning Zimbabwe's government not to use the COVID-19 pandemic as a pretext to stifle citizens' rights. The statement was delivered while more than a dozen citizens are in hiding for fear of persecution or prosecution for organizing an anti-government protest. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
7 countries, including the U.S., have urged Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa to keep the inauguration pledge he made in 2018 to respect human rights. Western diplomats joined forces in a statement saying their countries would continue to assist Zimbabwe in addressing the humanitarian crisis caused by recurring droughts and the COVID-19 pandemic. But the COVID-19 must not be used as an excuse to restrict citizens' fundamental freedoms. Freedoms of the press, of opinion, of expression, and of assembly are all universally recognized human rights and are guaranteed by the Zimbabwean Constitution. The government has also a responsibility to investigate and prosecute those responsible for violating human rights, said the seven embassies in the diplomatic message. Zimbabwe's Information Minister Monica Mchangwa said Saturday the government would not comment on the group statement by the US, Germany, Poland, Britain, Canada, Norway, and the Netherlands. Tafazwa Mugwadi, a spokesman for Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party, dismissed the statement by Western diplomats.
This is just a piece of rubbish. Nothing new except the usual rhetoric from the same culpable players whose hand has always been visible as far as disturbances in this country are concerned. Under what circumstances or under what basis do they have to instruct the government or the party or people of Zimbabwe to stop blaming them? How do they become immune from blame when they are equally blaming the government? They are blaming a government on whose neck they have imposed these illegal sanctions. It's just a bunch of nonsense.
Zimbabwe's political opposition and rights groups say Mnangagwa is moving away from his promise not to follow the playbook of his predecessor, longtime leader, the late Robert Mugabe, whose 37-year rule was littered with human rights abuses. The head of Human Rights Watch in Southern Africa, Dewa Mavinga, says the government must investigate the claims instead of dismissing them.
This is very important that the Zimbabwean government demonstrates that it respects human rights. Without this demonstration of respect for human rights or effort to revive the economy for international re-engagement will be wasted, because no one wants to do business with a country that does not respect rights, a country that brutalizes its own citizens, a country that looks the other way when there are obvious cases of abductions and torture of citizens by state agents.
Earlier this month, South Africa, which is the current chair of the African Union, sent envoys to engage with both the government of Zimbabwe and relevant stakeholders to identify possible ways in which South Africa can assist Zimbabwe. However, they left after meeting only with President Mnangagwa. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Cameroon says it is increasing security along its borders with the Central African Republic and Nigeria after suspected rebel incursions and interceptions of vehicles transporting explosives. Mokedwin Kindeka reports from Garoua, North Cameroon.
Government officials and the military braved a heavy downpour in northern Cameroon Monday to visit the commercial town of Pakete on the border with Nigeria. Jean Abate Edi, governor of Cameroon's north region where Pakete is located, says his trip is to make sure that the border with Nigeria is immediately secured. He says intelligence reports at his disposal indicate that security is threatened on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. He says henceforth, vehicles known locally as starlets are prohibited from transporting goods into Cameroon from Nigeria, and that the military has been reinforced along the Nigerian border. Edi did not say how many more troops have been deployed to the border zone. Jude Morfo, coordinator of a government operation to secure the border zone, says he invited the governor and his top officials because of the increasing wave of insecurity along the border. He says last week, the military intercepted two vehicles bringing into Cameroon explosives from Nigeria. He says scarlets are increasingly being used in transporting illegal and prohibited goods.
As our normal duty, we control everything that enters the country. This starlet was coming, and then we stopped it. It refused to stop. Our boys used a special technique that we have to stop vehicles. While controlling, the two occupants of the vehicle run away. It's when we discovered this stock of explosives.
Morpho said they had opened investigations to determine the origin and destination of the explosives. He said they also seized and were keeping what he describes as huge quantities of prohibited goods from Nigeria that may undermine the security of Cameroonians. The governor said he suspected that the explosives were either destined to commit atrocities in Cameroon or were in transit to the troubled neighboring Central African Republic. General Aga Robinson, commander of Cameroon troops fighting insecurity on Cameroon's border with CAR and Nigeria, also visited the border zones. Robinson says the military also has noticed an increase in the number of people abducted for ransom along Cameroon's border with CAR. Robinson says he has increased troops on that border because Cameroon has within a week reported 8 incursions from suspected CAR rebels.
We came to analyze the operations ongoing so that the success we are recording these days should continue. Came there also to talk to our soldiers to make them know that they have to carry out their mission with professional consciousness. We want to end by calling on the population to go towards those soldiers to denounce, and then they'll be able to defend them.
Robinson said in one of the incursions, the rebels left with an undisclosed number of cattle and money they seized from ranchers in the border town of Tinier. Civilians said two other attacks on merchants were reported in the border town of Galim. They said the rebels also seized gasoline and fled on motorcycles. Last Sunday, a confrontation with Cameroon military killed 3 suspected rebels remaining in Tinier. The Cameroon military said it seized war weapons from the rebels who had attacked to gain supplies, but gave no further details. Cameroon shares an 800-kilometer-long boundary with the landlocked CAR. There are currently some 250,000 CAR refugees in Cameroon. For the past 8 years, sectarian Christian and Muslim militias in CAR have been waging war against each other with horrific violence. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Garoua, Northern Cameroon.
The UN Human Rights Office is condemning excessive use of force by security guards that killed 22 inmates and injured 8 others during a mass escape at a Madagascar jail last week. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Security forces reportedly opened fire as hundreds of men were trying to escape from Madagascar's Farangana prison in the southeast of the country. The attempt largely failed. Out of 380 inmates, only 25 are still on the run. The UN Human Rights Office describes the squalid prison conditions as appalling and a hotbed for the spread of COVID-19. Agency spokesman Rupert Colville says it was the 7th attempted prison escape in the country since the coronavirus pandemic began. He says prisoners are living in fear of being stricken with this deadly disease.
As with many other jails, the conditions at Farafanjana are deeply troubling. The prison is overcrowded, conditions are generally unhygienic, food is poor, and the inmates lack proper access to health care. Our office has previously engaged with the authorities to express concerns about the conditions in the country's jails and the resultant dangers of overcrowding during the pandemic.
Colville says in the early stages of the pandemic, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet appealed to all countries to reduce overcrowded prison populations. He says she specifically urged the release of people at risk, including pregnant women, the disabled, the elderly, and minors. Colville tells VOA Malagasy authorities are aware of the problematic conditions in their prison system.
that, you know, president of Madagascar has had embarked on trying to make changes to the prison system with the main objective of decongesting the prisons. But clearly more remains to be done. And the fact that there have been 7 such escapes, that apparently the fact that it happened at the weekend is a factor because there's less security in the prisons at weekends.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling on the government to conduct a prompt, independent, and impartial investigation into the killings and injuries that occurred during the prison escape. It reminds authorities the use of force must comply with the principles of legality and necessity, and that it must be proportional and non-discriminatory. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Observers of an unfolding security crisis in Mozambique's northern Cabo Delgado province are concerned about what they perceive as lack of action to end it by the Southern African Development Community, or SADC. Insurgents linked to the Islamic State group began attacking towns in late 2017. Analysts say they have killed more than 1,000 people and the conflict has displaced hundreds of thousands more. Darren Taylor has the story.
Security analyst Liesel Lowe-Vordran says Mozambique's bad response to the crisis is to be expected from a country with such weak governance and military structures. But she adds that what's frustrated observers is the Mozambican authorities' attitude to the conflict.
Almost nihilism, trying to push a narrative that this is not terrorism, these are just criminals. And now another narrative that, right, these are external forces. The complete blackout on information is also not helpful. But it's a very, very...
Lowe-Vordran is a senior researcher for South Africa's Institute for Security Studies. She says some steps taken by Mozambique's government have in fact soured relations with their neighbours.
The government had hired mercenaries from Russia last year, and then this year private security companies led by a former Zimbabwean, but it's mostly South Africans. That has complicated the issue.
Yes, Mozambique's leaders should have done better, says the analyst. But even for a country with more resources, this would be a very difficult situation, as shown by extremist threats elsewhere in Africa.
In the Sahel, for example, you've got 15,000 troops of the UN in Mali, and you've got French troops and so on, and yet the threat is growing. One has to understand that it's very sensitive, it's very complex, and we really don't know exactly what these guys want and who their leaders are, etc.
But Lowe-Vordran says it's safe to make some conclusions about the situation in northern Mozambique.
It's not as if the Islamic State has led an invasion of Cabo Delgado province. It's taking advantage of an insurgency that started locally.
She warns that if SADC doesn't get involved strongly soon, a threat currently confined to northern Mozambique could become a danger to the entire region. Yet, despite 2 meetings discussing the issue, the organization has not announced a plan of action. Lowe-Vordran says this bothers her.
Other regional organizations like ECOWAS or the African Union also, from time to time, intervene in crisis with a plan and a roadmap and an assistance. The number one focus of such a response should be saving lives and protecting civilians. We just have absolutely no communication on that from SADC, and it would be preferable.
Her group suggests that SADC begins by sending a basic fact-finding mission led by a special envoy to Mozambique to investigate the situation in Cabo Delgado. Lowe-Vordran's sure that the international community would support a regional force being sent into the area to protect local inhabitants. SADC says it's paying due attention to the situation and will respond when appropriate using appropriate methods. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, Thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.